Well, this morning we are going to stay on the subject of what it means to be made in God's image, but we're going to apply that to a very specific, a very important, and a pressing cultural issue of our time. And if you've not faced this personally, you almost certainly will at some point. This is an issue that poses very difficult ethical decisions for us that have to be informed by our Christian worldview. And I'm talking about end-of-life situations, tough, tricky end-of-life situations. And we'll also talk about the so-called right-to-die movement. Now, why is this important for us as Christians to talk about this morning? Why do we come in here and devote time to this? Let me give you a couple of reasons. First, we have a calling by God to be salt and light in this culture, and I hope this is something we all take seriously. There is a growing push for the right to die, active euthanasia. In this culture, there's a growing push. There is money behind this, and there is a determined foe. And if the church does not bring God's truth to bear on this subject, who will? Think about that. If we do not influence policy, if we do not try to influence politicians and those who set the rules that affect everybody, particularly the most vulnerable among us, if we don't do that, if we don't fulfill our calling as salt and light, who is going to do that? Secondly, we need to talk about this subject because it's important for us personally, because we're going to face these situations in our lives. Professor Scott Ray from Biola University lectures on this topic, and he has said that 85% of his audience, when asked, have responded that they have had the experience of walking closely with someone in their final days of life. Of those in his audience who stated that they had been asked in those moments to contribute or to help make decisions when it comes to terminal care and particularly life support, whether to keep it, whether to remove it, he said that almost none of them have responded that they felt adequately prepared to make those decisions from the standpoint of a Christian worldview. So clearly, this is something that the church needs to talk about amongst ourselves, because we're going to likely face these situations. Now, personally, I don't know about you. Personally, I have not been involved in any such decisions, but I've sometimes been close enough to these situations to understand how difficult and complex they can be. And as many of you know, two summers ago, I spent almost every day in June driving up to Fort Wayne to see my best friend who was dying of cancer, slowly. Rob and I had been friends since childhood. We were really closer than brothers, and we spent just about every day of our childhood together, and many times all day of every day of our childhood together. And now, after 40 years, I'm watching my best friend slowly waste away. He'd always been really full of life. He'd been energetic and optimistic. And now I'm watching him just shrink. His pre-cancer weight, I believe, was 138 pounds. And when he died, he may have been 70 pounds. He was just skin on top of skeleton. And that was tough. Very hard to witness. During the 3 months that he suffered with cancer, he faced innumerable challenges, setbacks. He had bowel obstructions. He had surgeries and painful recoveries and equipment failures and fevers and hallucinations and the whole bit. It was just a terrible, terrible time. And it is not difficult for me to imagine how someone in a similar situation, particularly someone who does not have a Christian worldview, would say, let's just end this already. In the final weeks, Rob wasn't really even himself, understandably, and in the final days, he was not even conscious. And so I've been there, I've seen it firsthand, I know what it is like to want someone to live and yet to hate seeing how they are living and what they are having to endure. I know what it is like to have part of me wanting to see it over with, wanting to see death come, even for somebody that I love. And that's a very confusing emotion, as some of you know. And because I've been there, I have a bit of a sense of the ethical difficulties that surround situations like these. And people live this out every day. Every day somebody is asking, look, if Grandpa said he doesn't want to be resuscitated, do we have to honor that? Do we have to go by that? If we can keep Mom alive for another month, but the doctors are saying that she's going to die anyway, under what circumstances should we keep her alive? And is it good stewardship to spend tens of thousands of dollars just delaying the inevitable? My brother is in excruciating pain. If we give increasing doses of pain medication, will that hasten his death? Is that ethical? Our child is in a vegetative state. If his organs can't function on their own, to what extent are we ethically obligated to employ artificial means for keeping him alive? These are questions that people ask. They ask them every day. Can we all acknowledge this, that these are complex questions, that these don't have simple answers? Is that fair enough? And the Bible really doesn't speak directly to them. Indirectly, yes, but not directly to them. And so we're going to come back to some of these types of questions later, but only after laying the necessary groundwork, because we can only proceed with specific cases when the larger worldview questions have been asked and answered. Questions like, who am I? How did I get here? Questions like, where did we come from? Where are we going? What is human value? How is value determined? Are there limits to human autonomy? Meaning, who gets to decide? Who is ultimately in charge? And if there are limits to human autonomy, what are they? We're going to get to those. But I want to first give you a little bit of a brief history and talk about where we've come from and where we are. A lot of people think this is a new issue. It's actually not. Back in the 1800s, as late as the 1800s, there was a right to die movement in the United States. They argued that the Constitution guarantees that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process. And so they reasoned that if someone has a right to life, then they must also have the right to die. In the 1960s, the concept of a living will became popular. And many of you know what a living will is. In some ways, it propelled the right to die movement. But a living will just sets the parameters for treatment if somebody should, in the future, become unable to make life and death decisions for himself. Soon after this, in the 1970s, there was a landmark case that involved Karen Ann Quinlan. Karen Ann Quinlan had taken a combination of drugs and alcohol, apparently, and had slipped into a coma. And her parents prevailed in court. They wanted to take her off of an artificial respirator, and that was a landmark case, and it set the stage for future developments. In the 1990s, some of you will remember a guy by the name of Dr. Jack Kevorkian. He also went by the name Dr. Death. Dr. Death was from Michigan. He was the guy who invented the suicide machine and argued that it was ethical for him to teach people how to kill themselves. And he was in and out of court quite a bit, was eventually convicted of second-degree murder in 1999, served 8 years in prison. Some claimed that history would vindicate him and show him to be a hero, a man who was ahead of his times. Terry Schiavo, perhaps the most famous case relating to these matters. She died in 2005 when she was taken off of the nutrition that was keeping her alive. She had a feeding tube. Her husband argued in court that she did not want to live that way. And although there was no proof, I don't believe there was any proof of that. And that, now this was different than Karen Ann Quinlan, because this is not an artificial respirator. This is not extraordinary care. Now, this is simply food. This is ordinary care. And a judge ruled that she can be effectively starved to death, though she did not have a living will stating that that was her desire. Most recently, maybe you remember the name Brittany Maynard. Brittany Maynard came along a few years ago. She was a young gal from California in her 20s. If the Right to Die movement ever needed a poster child, she was the perfect one, young, attractive, articulate. And she argued that as a terminal brain cancer patient, she had the right to determine her fate so that she would not have to suffer. She moved from California, established residency in Oregon, which was the only state at that time, I believe the only state, that actually had doctor-assisted suicide. And she followed through with her plans. She ended up dying a few years ago at the hands of a physician. And so Oregon kind of pioneered this. But now physician-assisted suicide is legal in Oregon, California, Washington, Vermont, Colorado, and Washington, D.C., and it might be a couple other states. I think in Montana there's something going on there. It's a little ambiguous. But the trend, we need to understand that the trend is toward expansion. It's kind of like the whole same-sex marriage, so-called same-sex marriage thing. Once one state gets on board, it kind of travels like the plague. It's a domino effect. And so I think we're going to see more and more of this. I don't know what's going on in Ohio necessarily, but whereas fortunately, I think in the abortion debate, I think we're actually, we kind of have the wind at our backs a little bit because I think the graphic images make it more and more difficult for people to deny what abortion is. Unfortunately, I think when it comes to the Right to Die movement, we have an uphill battle for a number of reasons, and I'll maybe explain some of that if we have time. I'm hoping at the end we might even have a few minutes for question and answer. But right now in the world, there is no country that is pushing euthanasia more than the Netherlands. And maybe some of you are familiar with what is going on there. And let's hope that this is not where we are headed. But physician-assisted suicide was legalized in 2002 there. It was practiced long before that. But since that time, cases have been increasing about 10% annually. Now, in Holland, there are mobile death squads that drive around to kill the elderly, to kill the sick. They would say they drive around to serve the elderly and the sick. Originally, this was supposed to be for the terminally ill and those in extreme pain. Now they are killing the mentally ill. They are killing the depressed. There are an increasing number of involuntary victims, those that doctors deem unworthy of death, and that is documented, and victims as young as 12 years old. 5,300 victims of doctor-assisted suicide or doctor-practiced homicide, maybe we should say, in 2014. There is a dark cloud hanging over Holland. And it might be a good time for us, if we're saying, well, is that where we're going? It might be a good time for us to address what's sometimes called the slippery slope argument. You're familiar with that? The slippery slope argument says, well, actually, there's a saying, and I think the saying is true. What begins as a right later becomes a suggestion. And a suggestion later becomes an obligation. What begins as a right later becomes a suggestion. You have the right to die. You have the right to die with dignity. And then it becomes, well, don't you think you're kind of in the way? Don't you think you're consuming a lot of resources? Don't you think you're a burden on your family? And then that suggestion eventually becomes an obligation. We can't support you. You're too much of a burden on the health system. Now, as an argument against physician-assisted suicide, do you see a problem with the slippery slope argument? Or maybe a weakness? Even if physician-assisted suicide, what we have in Oregon and Colorado and elsewhere, even if that never progressed to the point that what you have in Holland, where they're actually literally putting people to death without any due process, just innocent people that they deem unworthy of life, even if it never gets there, it's still wrong. So there's nothing wrong with the slippery slope argument. We just have to understand the limitation. Same thing with abortion. Sometimes people say, well, abortion could eventually lead to infanticide. Well, actually, abortion is infanticide. But what they're saying is that eventually we're going to be killing one-year-olds and two-year-olds and that sort of thing. And for a while, people said, oh, no, that could never happen. And now you got Peter Singer, one of the most prominent ethicists. Isn't that funny? An ethicist is supposed to be an expert in what is right and what is wrong, saying, yeah, we really do need to extend that window of time for parents. Maybe it should be 2 years old, and we should have these killing centers. They'll be real sanitary. You take your kid in there, and yeah. But even if it never gets to that point, abortion is wrong. It's evil. Okay? Let's quickly define some terms, and then we're going to clarify the right to die position. And I think I've got some, just some terms here so that we're all on the same page. Euthanasia literally means good death. And I actually don't like the term, calling this a good death. Mercy killing is a phrase often associated with active euthanasia, and we'll talk in a little bit about the difference between active and passive euthanasia. Physician-assisted suicides, active euthanasia facilitated by a licensed physician, death with dignity, the reference to the ostensible or supposed motivation for legalized euthanasia, and physician-assisted suicide. A permanent vegetative state, or sometimes a persistent vegetative state, is a condition regarded as irreversible in which a patient has lost all mental activity, including thoughts, desires, emotions, and self-awareness. And then finally, right to die. This is just the notion that someone has the right to determine the time and the circumstances of his or her own death. Now, to clarify the right to die position, I want to quote from an article called Why Euthanasia Should Be Legal. And this is a little bit of a lengthy quote, but goes as follows. The right to choose is fundamental and applies to all elements of human life, which by the nature of human life includes the right to choose how you die. As an example, a terminally ill individual who is currently under significant pain may choose to die with dignity, as is his right. To deny him this is to deny him his personal autonomy and is an act of trespassing on his humanity. An individual possessing all the rights of a human being may perceive a dignified death to be preferable to constant suffering. There is an assumption being made here that you may have caught. He may decide on euthanasia, and this choice should be available to him. Very simply, this is his right to choose. It cannot be questioned should he decide to act on it. Now, consider that position as it relates to accountability. Does the man, in this view, answer to anyone outside of himself? No. No. The individual decides how and when he dies. Now, according to the secular humanist, the individual either may choose to let nature run its course or decide to take matters into his own hands, but that choice is his, and it is his alone. Do you see God in the picture anywhere here? And this, does this even acknowledge or recognize God, a maker? Now, what is the humanist view of man? Let's back up for a moment. God made man in his own image, or nature made man as an accident, product of impersonal evolutionary forces. Do you see how that speaks to value? Okay, so if this rests on the secular humanist worldview, do you see how that relates to value? I think it was Carl Sagan who used to say, you know, take a walk in the forest, and when you come across, you know, just a dried up stick in the woods, an insignificant stick laying on the ground, he said, that's you. You are no more significant. You are no more valuable. You were no more planned. You are basically just an artifact of evolution. Now hold on to that because that is important. We need to realize though, that the case for euthanasia, the case for physician-assisted suicide, rests on the secular humanist foundation. Now, if you have a worldview that says that people are without objective value, then you produce ideas that treat people as valueless. Do you see that? Here's the contradiction. With, you know, they say death with dignity. You can't have dignity without value. There is no dignity without value. The quote here says he may choose to die with dignity, but there's no foundation for that in the secular humanist worldview. You know where you get dignity? Here it is. Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. The humanist says, so impersonal evolution created man in the image of space dust. Where is their value? Where is their dignity? And so if you don't have a foundation for dignity, you have to borrow that concept from a theistic worldview, a worldview that recognizes God. And I would say that if you don't have a foundation for dignity, then you can't even define such a thing as death with dignity. Do you see the problem there? Let's look at another problem with this view, another inconsistency. We noted that the individual is in charge. The individual is autonomous in this view, okay? He has the right to choose. Do they really mean that? Of course they don't. They do not mean that. I'll prove it to you. What would most of them say? Advocates for death with dignity. What would most of them say if a 30-year-old woman with four children said, "Look, I can't make ends meet anymore. I'm tired of it all. I'm just going to die. I want to die." What would they say? Would they say, "Oh, well, your health plan should include that. It's just a tragedy. It doesn't." Or would they refer her to a suicide hotline? Are they respecting her supposed autonomy? You know, what if a young man says, "Look, I'm just depressed. I want to die. No, I'm healthy. I just want to die." Most of them would not support that. What if an 18-year-old girl said, "Look, I want to be in the news. I want a doctor to kill me because I want to go down in history as the healthiest person who ever chose doctor-assisted suicide." Would they say, "Well, that's your right. You're autonomous. You decide for yourself." Of course not. And so we all recognize that there have to be limits on autonomy. You see, nobody really believes in this concept of unlimited personal autonomy. There are problems with this death with dignity view, and they are at a foundational level. They are at a worldview level. Obviously, Christians impose limits on autonomy, too. The difference is that we have that we can do that consistently with our worldview. It flows out of that logically. Now, the reason I take the time to point this out is that we have to understand that these decisions can't be made outside of the proper foundation, the proper worldview. Okay, that's critical. We have to have an accurate understanding of who we are, what kind of beings we are, how we got here, what our destiny is, what our value is, and so forth. And so I want to quickly define two important biblical doctrines that are going to guide our ethics on end-of-life matters. And the first one we've already mentioned, namely, that we have been made in the image of the living God. That's no small thing. In fact, that's everything. We have been made in the image of the living God. We are unique in His creation. We are the pinnacle of all He has made. Some will say, there's a Little House on the Prairie episode. We like that in our house. And a guy gets shot. He's like an outlaw. And his brother is wanting to get him to a doctor. And the leader of the gang says, "No, we're not going to do that. He's going to die." And he says, "He's suffering. He's in pain, Lawrence. Go put him out of his misery." And the brother says, I can't. He says, "Lawrence, you'd do it for a horse. You'd do it for a horse." And we hear that. We hear people say, "Look, you'd take your dog to the vet if he was suffering." Yes, but my dog is not made in the image of God. We are of inestimable worth. You cannot put a dollar figure on a human being. And we have from Genesis 9, this gives us the foundation for the command that's going to come later in Exodus 20. Genesis 9 tells us why you shall not murder. It says, "From each man I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed." Talking about civil justice here as God decreed. "For in the image of God has God made man." Man is special. Secondly, the Bible teaches that humanity is accountable to God. Now, particularly for the Christian, right? Because the scriptures teach that you and I are not even our own. 1 Corinthians 6 says, "You are not your own. You are bought with a price. Therefore, honor God with your body." So the Christian of all people has to understand, I do not have a right to take my own life. This body isn't even mine. It's on loan. And that could have other implications. If you drink heavy or smoke a lot or don't exercise, ask yourself, is that a proper use of of the body that doesn't belong to me. But it certainly has implications when it comes to this question. But the whole world is accountable to God. That's what the scriptures teach over and over. Romans 14, therefore each of us will have to give an account of himself to God. That was written to believers, obviously. But God judged the nations for disobeying his law. You shall not murder. And that includes oneself. Now, these two doctrines are going to guide us. We're made in the image of God, and we answer to God, even in end-of-life situations. And I don't want to trudge through a whole bunch of different case studies. What I want to do instead is I want to give you six distinct categories that pretty much are going to cover the gamut. Almost every end-of-life situation is going to fall into one of these six categories, and I think you're going to find this helpful. So, and I've got some slides to go along with this. Boy, that's hard to read. tried to make that as big as possible, but three types of consent. Let's start there. There would be voluntary euthanasia, which means that the patient has expressed a desire to die. Voluntary euthanasia. Non-voluntary euthanasia means that the patient has not expressed a desire one way or the other, and most often is incapable of doing so. And then involuntary euthanasia would mean that the patient has expressed a desire to live. There are two means of death. One is active, which is the direct, the instrumental, and intentional killing of another. And an example of that would be like lethal injection. And there's also passive euthanasia, indirect, allowing of someone to die when it may be possible to prolong their life either through ordinary or extraordinary care. And so look at how this works here. We're going to start over in active and involuntary because that's probably the one that is the most obviously wrong. Okay. Red means stop, right? Okay. Killing someone against his wishes, suffocating, say, a terminally ill patient. This is the kind of thing that's happening in Holland. I think almost everybody, and this is not legal anywhere in the United States, almost all of us, even unbelievers, would say that's wrong. Killing someone, next, active non-voluntary. Killing someone who is unable to express his wishes. So maybe think of an Alzheimer's patient. That's another thing that's happening in the Netherlands. A lot of dementia, people who are suffering with dementia. Well, they can't make up their mind. They can't obviously don't have that capacity. So we'll decide for them. Involuntary, passive would be allowing someone to die who has asked to live. So, for example, refusing treatment to a cancer patient whose chances of survival are deemed too low. That would be the bottom right one there. Active voluntary, killing someone at his request. That would be like the Brittany Maynard example in Oregon, physician-assisted suicide. Now, these other two, passive voluntary. This would be allowing someone to die at his explicit request. And you think of like a do not resuscitate order. Most Christian ethicists would say that that is possibly permissible under certain conditions. And then finally, non-voluntary passive, allowing someone to die who cannot express his wishes. Think of like a stroke victim who is brain dead. Okay. The first thing maybe to say here is that there would be some debate on that bottom right one there, involuntary passive. Should that be a red or a yellow? Some would argue that we can envision a situation that might fall in that category and still be permissible. For example, a terminal unresponsive patient who had earlier stated a desire to live, but things have changed a lot and medical options have run out. Time is short and life prolonging treatments are actually increasing pain and just delaying the inevitable, making it worse. Another thing to notice here in this chart, and this is really, I think, the only six possibilities. Almost everything has to fall into this. And so notice something here. We've got red for stop, and yellow, by the way, does not mean, most of our guys are like, yellow means speed up, right? No, yellow means we're going to have to consider several factors. And then green. Notice we don't have a green here, okay? Only reds and yellows. There are no automatically ethical categories. Some would say the top left, or I'm sorry, the bottom left, voluntary passive, that would always be ethical. Well, not so fast. I think we can imagine scenarios in which it would be unethical to allow someone to die, even if they requested it, right? Someone that's condition isn't really terminal, but maybe they just want to give up. Maybe they need some help with depression or whatever it might be. Also notice this. All active forms are red because they are clearly murder. And now the world isn't going to agree with that. But that is the Christian worldview, that all active forms of euthanasia, actively killing someone, would be unethical. I think of the story in 1 Samuel 31, and it goes into 2 Samuel 1. I don't know if you remember this, when Saul was going to battle with the Philistines, and it says that the Philistine archers came upon him and they wounded him. And he said to his armor bearer, he said, "Run me through so that these uncircumcised fellows don't get their hands on me." And the armor bearer wouldn't do it. And so Saul fell on his own sword. And then the armor bearer did the same thing. And then in chapter 2, we see this Amalekite running up to David and saying, "Look, I have Saul's stuff." "Well, what happened?" "Oh, well, I came upon him and he said, I'm terribly wounded. Finish me off." And so I stood over him and I ran him through with my sword. And David said, "You'll be put to death." He didn't say, "Oh, nice job. Mercy killing. Way to go." David said, "You killed the Lord's anointed. What made you think you could do that? You shall not murder." Okay, so from the Christian worldview, active forms of euthanasia are in the red category. All right. Some would look at this chart and they would say, "Look, you shouldn't even distinguish between active and passive euthanasia." Some have argued that passive euthanasia justifies active euthanasia. And so they'd say almost everybody would imagine scenarios in which it would be okay to allow someone to die under certain circumstances. And they say passive and active are the same thing. And they use this illustration. I read one of them said, "Look, if you see a drowning child in the lake and you sit there and you just pull up a bench and you watch him drown for entertainment's sake, how is that morally better than wading out there and putting their head underwater?" They say active and passive have the same ultimate result, and so they're the same. So let's get rid of those categories. And what I would say to that is that far from justifying active euthanasia, well, I think what that tells us is that passive euthanasia can be just as bad in some cases. So that doesn't help their position as I see it. We should also note that there's a difference, and this is important. There's a difference between intending death and foreseeing death. You might find yourself in a situation with grandma or grandpa or mom or dad or somebody at some point in the future, and knowing that what you do might actually hasten death, and you'll have to ask yourself, is that ethical? The example I used earlier, sometimes when people are in a great deal of pain, and by the way, what does the scripture say about pain? Is that something like with the Good Samaritan? Did the Good Samaritan come across this man and say, "Well, pain is actually good. It's a teacher." Is that what he said? No, he bandaged them up and he tried to relieve his pain. And so, yes, pain can be a teacher, but in doing to others as you would have them do to you, we want to relieve pain. And so you have this situation with grandma and grandpa, and they're in a lot of pain, and they say, look, we can give more morphine, we can increase this, but what it's going to do is it's going to make them unresponsive, and it's actually going to mean they'll die sooner. What do you do with that? Do you say, well, then I'll be guilty of murder? And this is where it's important to have this distinction between intending and foreseeing death. If I come across a car accident and somebody's inside and they're being burned alive, they're getting third degree burns, and I realize I can't get this guy out of this car without breaking his arm. Okay. Does that mean if I pull him out and I break his arm, does that mean that I'm culpable? You broke his arm. You should be punished. No, I did not intend to break his arm, but I foresaw it. You see, there are times in these end-of-life situations where we can foresee an outcome. This may cause the hastening of death, or this will cause the hastening of death, but that's not the intention. The intention is to relieve pain. Does that make sense? I know that's a little bit nuanced, but I think it's an important distinction that's going to help you if you are able to process that. It's also worth noting that ethicists make a distinction between ordinary and extraordinary means of care. And we talked about that earlier. To withhold food and water, for example. Sometimes babies are born and they just let them starve because they have some kind of condition. That is ordinary care. That's not extraordinary care. That's not an artificial organ, okay? So to withhold food and water would be an active euthanasia, okay? Because they're ordinary care. But an artificial respirator we would see more as passive euthanasia. It's always wrong to deny ordinary care. It may be ethical in some cases to deny extraordinary care. I hope that makes sense. As we're making these choices, some Christians would tell you this. They would sit off at a distance and they would climb aboard their high horse and they would say, money should never even enter the equation. Cost should not be a factor. Okay, these are the Christians that are really good at making everybody else feel terrible. Okay, there are a few of them around. Hopefully not here. They would say money should not even be a consideration. That's a very easy thing for someone who is outside of the situation to say. Put them in the situation, that might change. Let me offer a scenario for you to consider. Mr. and Mrs. Jones are in their 60s. He has a living will in which he has expressed a desire never to be on permanent life support. He suffers a traumatic injury that has left him in a permanent vegetative state. A month and a half later, his condition has not changed. Doctors have said it will never change. Mrs. Jones has spent $90,000, three-fourths of her savings, on his care. Now, obviously, and if nothing will change, if he is going to die, obviously, in this case, money can be considered as a factor. It's not the only factor. It's not the most important factor, but it is a factor. And to pretend that we can just kind of cross that off the list as things we should never think about, I think is both unrealistic and I think it's uncompassionate. As an absolute rule, we never, ever kill to save money. We don't actively kill. That's clearly unethical. But it may be permissible in some cases to hasten a decision to allow passive euthanasia. All right, let me review a little bit before we wrap up. Is it ever acceptable to actively kill? Is that the job of the medical community? Clearly not. Is it okay to withhold life-saving care? In some cases, it may be. Is it ever okay to withdraw care? Again, in extraordinary care, in cases of extraordinary care, yes, perhaps. How far do we have to go in attempting to prolong or preserve life? That depends on one's prognosis. Some people say, well, there's no limits. You know, it doesn't matter what the doctors say. The doctors have been wrong before. And so we just keep them hooked up to all that equipment and all those machines for as long as it takes, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. You ever heard that? That actually used to be my view, by the way. You know, God can heal someone, so you never take them off of that. Well, it's true. God can heal. But let me tell you something. He can heal even if you take them off the respirator. Okay? Should cost ever come into the discussion? Yes, but never to justify active euthanasia. It might affect the timing of an inevitable decision for passive euthanasia. And should a burden to the family come into the discussion? I would say that like cost, it never justifies active euthanasia, but it may affect the timing of a decision for passive euthanasia. Three quick exhortations for us in laying out a positive proposal for the church as it relates to end-of-life situations, okay? We don't want to be a people that says, no euthanasia, and that's our view, okay? We want to have a positive proposal for these difficult situations. And three things real quickly. The first one relates to care and visitation. It may come as a surprise to some people that even secular-minded people, what they most want in these situations as a patient oftentimes is not the mere relief of pain. In fact, most people would say that it would be preferable to die with pain while surrounded by family and friends versus dying without pain in a cold, empty room. What does that mean for us? This is where the body of Christ comes in. God forbid that we are ever too busy to care for those who are in their dying days. And I'm not just talking about mom and dad and close relatives. You've heard of the visitation pastor, right? I'm not condemning any visitation pastor, okay? I'm not condemning any church that has hired a visitation pastor. But I will say this. If your church has to hire a visitation pastor, then there's something wrong. There's something wrong if a church just lets their elderly go suffer alone in a nursing home and then pays somebody to go and visit them. That's not being the church. You might recall a few years ago, our dear brother Dale Smith, dying of cancer. I did not have to tell you to go visit him. I may have reminded you. I don't know. But I know that there are lots of people who were coming and going and taking cards and taking food and loving Dale and his wife. You went because you understood that you are the church. You took your children. As far as I know, none of your children had taken seminary classes in pastoral visitation. But they ministered to him, probably as well as any expert could do. We're the church. We need to take the gospel to those who are dying. To those who are in Christ, they need the comfort of the gospel they already embrace. To those who don't have Christ, they need to hear the gospel while they still have breath. To say that we have done this well, and I think we have, is not to say that we can't do it better. The Apostle Paul has advice for churches in his letters. He has advice for churches who are doing things well. And the expression is more and more. And so he says to the Thessalonians, for example, you're loving the brothers. Good, you're loving them. Do it more and more. And I would say to you, more and more, let's care for the weak, the elderly, those who are in their dying days. Second exhortation, be a voice. I think the church is finding its voice somewhat when it comes to abortion, at least we're starting to. On euthanasia, I don't think so much. And I don't think it's out of cowardice. I think it's just out of ignorance. It's not an issue that's like front and center very often. I think that needs to change. We need to fight the humanist devaluation of life on all fronts, including this one. Finally, put our money where our mouth is. We need to be prepared to offer financial assistance to those in their dying days, to families who are making end-of-life decisions. It may be to help purchase equipment for hospice situations. It may mean gas cards for families who are running back and forth to the doctor. Whatever financial costs may be imposed on those families, I think the church needs to be prepared to step in and help financially. Think about it. Of all the things we spend our money on, can you think of anything that is a better investment? Well, you think about how weird we are in this culture, because the world obviously values youth, right? They value vitality. The world does not value the aged and the infirmed. And when somebody starts to get old and wrinkled, then they're not going to be the spokesman for the company anymore. They're not going to be in the commercials anymore. And if you cannot contribute to a productive society, or we believe that about you, you're a burden, then you're no longer worthwhile. But we are not the world. We are the church. And we see the world through the eyes of Christ. And we understand that every human being is made in His image. And so we are the church. And I'm going to close with Matthew 25, verse 37. And then we're going to sing. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? The king will reply, I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me.